This is Jim Inkster, and our guest is Ellen Keith. She's a Canadian writer, recent graduate of the University of British Columbia's MFA program in creative writing, and her work has appeared in many publications, and she has received the Anton Fiction Prize and the James Patrick Follansbee Memorial Scholarship in Creative Writing. Her work is The Dutch Wife, a novel that has captivated many. During wartime, we do what we must. And what was the genesis of this book with Amsterdam, May of 1943 as the backdrop, Ellen Keith?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me to talk to you today. The Dutch Wife is my first novel, and it's a historical fiction novel set during World War II. So the basic story is the main character, Marijke, and her husband are deported to the concentration camps from their home in Amsterdam. They've been working in the Dutch resistance. And in her effort to find him again, Marijke faces a terrible choice, even by concentration camp standards. And so this novel originated with the idea of, I was studying history during my undergraduate degree and really with a focus on Holocaust studies. And I had heard so many stories, read so many books about the Holocaust, and I wanted to explore it a little bit more, but I wanted to try and find a different angle to look at. And I decided to start out with the idea of looking at an SS officer and try to get a bit into the psychology of what would motivate an average German citizen to get so swept up in everything that was going on in Nazi Germany at the time.
Well, this is a story that probably was the most horrid, I don't think there's any question, of the 20th century, the Third Reich and the evil within and the people who died as a result of World War II and Adolf Hitler. And you're a young person. How did you become mesmerized by this subject?
For me, it really started out already when I was about 10 years old. My family went on a big camping trip across Europe. And I was really moved by all the remnants of the war that I saw. We had the experience of standing in old World War II bunkers, finding debris from the exact plane that my great uncle was shot down in during the war. And that interest for me really grew the more time I spent in Holland, where my maternal grandparents are from. Even though my grandmother was just a little girl at the time of the war, she still remembers how difficult life was under Nazi occupation, how they had to try to survive eating turnips and tulip bulbs. And her brother actually died at age 20 while in hiding because he was supposed to be sent to Germany for hard labor. And he got sick, but they couldn't call a doctor because that would expose him. So I was really fascinated by all these stories, and that kind of interest in World War II history has just grown over the years.
Well, Amsterdam of today is one of the amazing cities on the planet, and it has just about everything, good, bad, and indifferent, and people who are probably the most educated on the planet and the most beautiful on the planet, if some stories are accurate, and I've been there, I can say they're pretty attractive. They're certainly bigger than Americans are, as in height, but in 1943, and we're talking only 75 years ago, how was it in Amsterdam?
Well, I think everyone was completely immersed in the experience of the war, and you had the choice of either trying to resist what was going on under the occupation, collaborating, or just trying to live your life as normally as possible. And there was quite a big Dutch resistance movement that evolved during the course of the war. Actually, I'm currently living in Amsterdam, and the apartment I live in, we have a newspaper from 1940 hanging on the wall that was uncovered during renovations of our bathroom. And there was a hiding spot in the bathroom that someone would have used during the war. And I think almost every house has some sort of story still, some links. And for me, it's just a really strong reminder of how this was just part of your everyday experience trying to survive.
Well, your story centers on a couple who were arrested and deported to different concentration camps in Germany. Tell us about how this unfolds.
Well, so they're originally arrested for making crystal radios for people to be able to listen to the BBC. The Dutch government is in exile in London, and so Dutch citizens want to secretly still stay on top of what's actually going on in the war, as opposed to what they're just hearing from German propaganda. And the couple, yeah, they're arrested one night, and they're deported first to a transit camp, and then they're sent to separate concentration camps in Germany.
And it was not a pleasant experience, to say the least.
No, definitely not. I think anyone who was imprisoned in these camps had absolutely horrible circumstances that they were trying to live under. In these cases, because they were Gentiles and involved as political prisoners, they had slightly better working conditions than, say, Jewish prisoners would have had. But, of course, it was still a daily battle for life and death.
And the Dutch wife, the subject of the title of your book, is given an absolutely terrible choice for survival.
Yes, her choice, ultimately, she has to choose whether or not she'll work in a camp brothel, which for her could afford her some protections that the general population didn't have. There were brothels that were set up in the in 1942-1943 as a result of a decision by Himmler. He wanted to set up a sort of reward system for prisoners to try and boost the economic productivity of the labor force. So they could either go to a camp cinema if they were seen to be behaving well, or they could check a book out of the library, or the ultimate reward in this sense was to visit the camp brothel.
And there is an SS officer who is a main character in your story, and this SS officer certainly has a bit of a conscience.
Yes, for me that was a character that I really wanted to try to portray fairly. I purposely chose someone who had some power in the camp but was still fairly low down the chain in terms of Nazi hierarchy, because I really wanted to explore the mindset of a relatively normal German person who got so involved in the atrocities in the war. And I wanted to see, how is he justifying what he's doing? How can he sleep at night? What is he telling himself to get through the day-to-day brutality of the camp?
And your story, The Dutch Wife, from Ellen Keith, it expands to Argentina. And that is a land where some Germans, war criminals in particular, Nazi war criminals, sought shelter after being pursued in Europe. Well, what happens in Argentina?
Well, I don't want to give away too much of the story, but it's set during 1977, so in the middle of the military junta that had taken over in the mid-1970s. And I was really struck by the amount of parallels that what was happening in, say, Chile and Argentina at this time compared to what was happening in Nazi-occupied Europe. People were being persecuted for their sexual orientation, for their political beliefs, for being outspoken in some way or another. And in this case, about 30,000 people disappeared from 1976 to 1983. And in most cases, this meant death. A lot of people today still have no idea what happened to their sons, daughters, and grandchildren. They just know that they were taken away one day and they never saw them again.
Independent of all the intrigue about wars and the major event of the 20th century, one reviewer says the novel is about the blurred lines between love and lust. What do you think, Ellen?
Yes, for me, what happens in the novel is eventually Carl, this SS officer, he comes in contact with Marijke, the Dutch woman, and he's quite taken by her. She's, unlike most of the prisoners, she still has quite a bit of spark left in her, and she's really determined not to be worn down. And so, of course, he begins to develop some feelings for her. And I really wanted to look at how things get blurred, mixed together. When you're in a conflict like this, you have to make decisions that you would never fathom having to make, and it puts everyone's morals in question. So I wanted to take a look at what happens when two people who are on opposite sides of the war get thrown into a situation like this, how they interact with each other, how they view each other, and at what point they still see each other as human.
It's quite a remarkable book. Another reviewer says literature at its very best tasks itself with difficult questions, and The Dutch Wife places itself in that noble tradition. Thank you, Ellen Keith.
Thank you again so much for having me.
Our pleasure, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Coming later in the hour, Mary Jo McConaughey. The book is The Tango War, the struggle for the hearts, minds, and riches of Latin America during World War II. But next, it's Eric David Dawson, the CEO and co-founder of Peace First. The book is Putting Peace First, Seven Commitments to Change the World. This is Talk Louisiana on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster, and we're joined by Eric David Dawson. He's the CEO of Peace First, an organization he helped launch at the age of 18. Along the way, Eric has directed a summer camp in Boston's public housing complexes, worked in election endeavors, and served as the driver for the author of Curious George. Today, he travels the world supporting young peacemakers in their efforts to make lasting change. His book is Putting Peace First, Seven Commitments to Change the World. Good morning, Eric David Dawson.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you, and I think all of us want peace, but it can be an elusive goal, can't it?
That's right. And what I want to do it with this book, and what I want to do for young people, is take this concept that feels so both meaty and complicated, and also very ephemeral. Right? It's holding hands and singing songs. It's often defined by what it's not: an absence of war, an absence of tension. And to create something that was muscular and accessible for young people. So to take this concept of peace and peacemaking and define it as compassion, so reaching out across lines of difference to connect with other people, courage, the ability to take a risk and stand up for someone else, and then collaborative leadership to work with other people and bring them along. And that peacemaking is something that we can all do, and we can all do it every day.
You take issue with the promise that many adults make to children that they'll change the world at some future time. Why does this get on your last nerve?
I was a graduation speaker at an elementary school in California, and I started my speech by telling these young people they'd been lied to by their teachers. And it was like this incredibly uncomfortable silence as all the adults looked at me. And I went on to explain that so often what adults do is they talk to young people and tell them they're the future, that someday they're going to be great writers, activists, leaders. And we define young people's potential. And the problem with that is, therefore, they don't have any power in the moment. And so what I want us to do is to move away from talking about what young people could be or what they will be. You know, what are you going to do when you grow up? And instead talk about what young people are able to do right now. Because, in fact, some of the most important drivers of culture change, of justice work, are young people because of their proximity to the problem and because they're not embedded in our traditional ways of thinking.
Well, recently we know we've had a Supreme Court judicial nominee being questioned about his high school days. You started Peace First at a very young age, and you've been doing this about 25 years. What's the connection to your formative years when you were in high school?
So in many ways, I was a pretty typical kid. I grew up in the Midwest, went to a large public high school with about 2,800 students. And there was a lot going on in the world that bothered me. You know, I grew up in the 80s and early 90s when nuclear war was a present danger, you know, issues of disinvestment in programs for people who most needed it, the safety net was getting frayed. And there's just issues in my community. So I grew up at the start of the inclusion movement, which meant that kids with disabilities who had before been kept in substantially separate classrooms and learning environments were being what they called mainstream, so joining the regular education population for classes. And, of course, there was no support for either group of students around that, and my peers were pretty crappy to our classmates. They made fun of them. They humiliated them, sometimes physically assaulted them. And that just bothered me. It bothered me that that was who we were as a school. And so as a 14-year-old, using, you know, what little social capital I had, began organizing my high school to change the culture of our school. So making that kind of behavior, that kind of activity, unacceptable. And because it was student-to-student, changing that culture was incredibly effective. Rather than principals saying we're a zero-tolerance policy school, we don't do that, it was student-to-student shifting our culture. And so for me, it was the first time I got to feel powerful that these sort of big issues, whether that's nuclear war or disengagement or global warming, that I could actually impact that within my proximal community.
And from a young age, you say, Eric, that we're often taught not to act. What do you mean by this?
So, you know, it's interesting. I'm a parent, and I've been talking to a lot of parents and educators, and there's this real fear of failure that we, I think, instill in our kids, this sort of free-floating anxiety. Now, I remember when my son was learning to walk, and, you know, he was 11 months, and, you know, the first thing he did is he fell down, right? He took a couple steps, and then he tumbled on his head, and then he got up and tried again. You know, and if in that moment I had said, okay, let's just stop this, I'm just going to carry you till you're 30, he never would have gone through that process of learning how to move through the world using his body. And we do that to young people. You know, we tell them that the world is scary, that they're in danger, and that our job is to protect them. You know, and there's truth in all of that. But we've got to let young people act. We've got to let young people take risks. We've got to let them try things. And to fail in that work. And so a big thing I talk about with young people is how to take risks, smart risks, safe risks, but they have to step outside themselves. You know, so often I think our culture starts with what's in it for me, what do I get from it? And then we move to the space about what am I willing to give, what am I willing to contribute? But rarely do we take that next step and ask, what am I willing to give up? What am I willing to risk to make something happen? And so what we often instruct young people is not to get involved, to mind their own business. And really, I think we need to send young people a different message, which is not only can you make a difference, but you actually have to make a difference.
Well, like the seven youth whose activism you illuminate in the book, those who've picked up the pieces following the Parkland shootings in Florida have revealed how articulate and engaging young people can be. Has this been a lesson to all of us?
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. There's always this awakening periodically that young people are here and that they're citizens and that they're engaged. And then we act surprised. You know, we studied movements over the past 120 years, from the workers' rights movements all the way up to the Arab Spring, marriage equality, Occupy. And in every single one of these examples, the work was powered by young people. You know, young people are our most powerful creators of culture, music, fashion, values. And so I think what Parkland has done is not so much something new, although everything is new with each generation, but a reminder that young people are at the forefront of justice work, whether that's building more inclusive schools, thinking about how police interact with communities of color, or thinking about what it means to be safe inside your school. Young people are inventing and creating communities and worlds that you and I will grow old in.
Now, Eric, you say, and I don't think there's any question you're correct, that we live in a culture celebrating flamboyance, the flamboyant leader, the great orator, the creative dynamo. We're looking for heroes, but you also believe that leaders sometimes come in different shapes and sizes.
That's so right. You know, I think we are invested in certain models of leadership, which tend to be male, which tend to be white, which tend to be heterosexual and privileged in certain ways. And so we judge everything against that standard. we also tend to focus on individuals and moments. I mean, I think about the civil rights movement, and we tend to think about Dr. King and Selma. You know, when in fact the civil rights movement was, you know, decades in the making, and it was hundreds of thousands of people, mostly women, mostly young people, sitting in church pews and around kitchen tables deciding they were going to be different, right? And it takes that network of leadership. You know, one of the things that we have our young people do, and this book is a how-to book, it actually helps young people create projects, is they have to build their team. They have to work with unlikely allies, because nobody can do something alone. And the most powerful leaders that I met interviewing young people all over the country for this book were the ones who were able to galvanize other people to build that community.
Well, the book is Putting Peace First, Seven Commitments to Change the World, from Eric David Dawson, the CEO and co-founder of Peace First. It's been a pleasure, Eric.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Talk Louisiana on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We're joined now by Mary Jo McConaughey. She is the author of The Tango War, The Struggle for the Hearts, Minds, and Riches of Latin America During World War II. It's a story that has not been told in many places, but it is a captivating story that needs scrutiny, and that is just what our esteemed journalist Mary Jo McConaughey is doing. Mary Jo, you're filling, I think, an important gap in World War II history, and it's one that, has not been detailed a great deal. What captivated you to this subject?
I've always been interested in World War II, Jim, ever since I was a kid. My father was a Navy veteran who served in many parts of the world in World War II, and he used to tell little anecdotes about his service in Latin America. And I was a journalist reporting out of Latin America for many years, but I could never follow up these kind of stories he told me. And when he was gone, I had no one to ask anymore. And I saw that there was not a book that I could find in English that told me the story of what happened during World War II in Latin America, even though I knew full well that both sides were active in the whole region. So I wrote the book that I wanted to read.
Well, it is a book that's about Latin America, and in this time in history, despite its proximity to the U.S., it was by no means a given that the region would side with the Allies. What was going on in Latin America at that time?
In those years, the Latin countries had active fascist organizations, many of them homegrown, not necessarily spurred by the Nazis in Germany. And many had dictators who were fond of Mussolini's way of doing things or Hitler's way of doing things insofar as organizing the workforce, providing jobs. Remember, Mussolini made the trains run on time, and that was a period when many of the countries would have been pleased to have good rail systems to begin with. So there was admiration for the Reich and for Mussolini. And remember that the United States was not the favorite country in the world for many of those nations, because gunboat diplomacy had been the rule before President Franklin Delano Roosevelt employed his good neighbor policy, which was meant to resolve differences with diplomacy rather than military occupation and military threats. But that hadn't quite filtered down to most of the population yet. So it wasn't, as you say, a given that those countries would side with the United States in any coming war.
And you note that Axis Airlines ruled the Latin skies until 1941, and Latin oil flowed to fascist forces. What caused that to change?
What caused it to change was, in the case of German and Italian airlines, some very, very astute diplomatic work, and also some very clever, in fact, bloodless espionage that got rid of the Italian airlines using a huge trick, you might say, a trick of espionage. And with regard to the oil, you know, the oil had been boycotted of Mexico by the big oil companies, Standard, Shell, and Texaco, after the president of Mexico, Lázaro Cárdenas, nationalized Mexican oil so that more of the profit from the oil industry could go back into the coffers of the country to provide fuel, you might say, for their own social programs. He was willing to sell the nationalized oil to the democratic countries. He was a Democrat, but neither France nor England nor the United States would defy big oil and buy Mexican oil. So he ended up selling it to a small operator, William Rhodes Davis, who then sold to the Reich and to Mussolini. Finally, after 1942, when U-boats sank a couple of Mexican oil tankers, the Mexican government did give up its neutrality. See, most of those countries wanted to remain at least neutral because they were smaller countries. It's just smarter and better for small countries to continue trade.
Well, Mary Jo, you make reference to the fact that Mexican pilots actually flew in the Philippines, and 25,000 Brazilians breached the Gothic Line in Italy. So the win by the Allies in World War II was certainly in part because of the heroics of soldiers from Latin America.
They certainly played their part. The Soaring Eagles is what the Mexicans called themselves, and they went up to train in Texas and fought alongside General MacArthur in the Philippines. And the Brazilians went to northern Italy, and they did this at a critical time because many of the Allied troops were being taken out of Italy to prepare for D-Day, for the invasion of Normandy, and the Brazilians and some other international troops went up and with high losses, but eventually, as you say, breaching the Gothic Line. And these Brazilians, by the way, called themselves the Smoking Cobras. Why? Because Hitler reputedly once said, "Oh, sure, the Brazilians will fight when the snake smokes." So they showed him.
Well, this is an interesting turnabout because in 1939, with World War II in the offing, President Roosevelt had stated that his greatest fear was that the Nazis, it was not that the Nazis would take over Europe, but that fascist subversion in Latin America would threaten the United States. What was his concern related to?
Well, I think there were three, because you had great numbers of people who were of the ethnicity of the Axis countries. That is, Germans and Germans. There were a million Germans in southern Brazil, for instance. And there were Japanese. There were more Japanese in Brazil than any other place than Japan. And Italians, of course, especially in Argentina. And so he was concerned about a fifth column. But he was also concerned, Jim, about the geography. That hump of Brazil reaches out into the Atlantic, almost meets, in geographical terms, that hump of Africa. Not really, but there's only 1,800 miles between them. And his concern was that it was going to be a trampoline for invasion of Latin America and a staging for anything that they may need to do to invade the United States. You know, most of the listeners and certainly myself were born after the war, and we know that the Allies won, end of stories, but what we don't realize was the atmosphere of the times when it was by no means certain that the Axis would not win. And the United States had plans to send 100,000 men to that section of Brazil to guard against an invasion by the Nazis, who, by the way, had control sooner or later of that part of Africa that had been colonized by France, for instance, which they occupied. And that operation, which never took place, even though the biggest base building operation of the U.S. Navy took place there during the war, that operation was called Operation Rubber. And that leads to Roosevelt's third concern, which was that the United States, the Allies, badly needed the natural resources for waging war that Latin America had: tungsten, manganese, industrial diamonds, and rubber, of course.
Well, the Tango War also goes into detail about what happened after the war, and as we know, fascists with blood on their hands ended up in some cases in the Americas. How did this happen?
Yes. At the end of the war, the various secret services of both the Americas, that is the United States and Latin America, offered to bring certain Nazis, particularly that is, those who had belonged to the party but were involved in industrial defense industry work and rocket work. The United States got some of them, and Latin America was quite welcoming to many others, and their way was paved by certain bishops in the Catholic Church who felt that these Nazis had to be protected because they would be, till the end of their days, anti-communist. And these bishops felt that communism and the Catholic Church could not exist in the same world, and they were looking ahead to the Cold War.
Well, it's a fascinating account of what happened in World War II in Latin America, the Tango War, the struggle for the hearts, minds, and riches of Latin America during World War II, a gripping and little-known story of the fight for the allegiance of Latin America. We thank you for telling that story and joining us today, Mary Jo McConaughey. This is Jim Inkster, and we switch gears just a bit. It is a big day for the LSU football Tigers. They'll close the 2018 season on the first day of 2019. And once again, Happy New Year to you as the Fighting Tigers face unbeaten Central Florida in the Fiesta Bowl in just more than a couple of hours away. And James Moran, the editor of Tiger Rag, of which I am the president, he is with us, and he is covering the game in Arizona. And James Moran, LSU is favored over a team that has a remarkable winning streak, but the Tigers, despite losing their regular season finale on seven overtimes, they're more than a touchdown favorite. What's going on?
Well, first of all, Jim, I want to say Happy New Year to you and all the listeners back there in Baton Rouge out here in the desert. And I think what's going on is that, well, for one, UCF's missing their quarterback. Mackenzie Milton, he's been their quarterback throughout this kind of undefeated run they've been on. He suffered a pretty gruesome knee injury about a month or two back, and he won't be playing. They have a very capable backup, but I get the sense that the odds makers don't think he's ever seen a defense quite like this LSU defense, though. LSU's a bit shorthanded in its own right. They're going to be playing without Greedy Williams and Christian Fulton. They're starting corners. It's kind of an interesting matchup. I think the thinking behind the odds is that while UCF was a little bit better last year and beat Auburn, that Auburn was a little bit disinterested for that Peach Bowl game after getting left out of the playoffs, whereas LSU, 10-win season on the line, their first New Year's Six Bowl ever, their biggest bowl game since the Alabama game back in January of 2012, that they'll be much more up for this game and that they're just kind of a deeper, bigger, faster, stronger team.
But when all is said and done, what is the big difference, if any, between a 9-4 season and a 10-3 season for LSU?
Well, for Ed Orgeron, it's a pretty nice incentive bonus, if you mean for him specifically. He gets a nice bonus if he gets to a 10-win season. I just think it's all about momentum. You know, if they hadn't had a 10-win season since 2012. There's something nice about that round number and the way it sets you up for a 2019 season where, aside from going to Alabama, a lot of their tougher games will be at home. And, you know, they're bringing back their quarterback. They're bringing back a lot of pieces on this offense and defense. They're signing a big-time recruiting class. I just think that, you know, if you look at last year, they kind of have the same opportunity in front of them. They blow the bowl game to Notre Dame, and then all of a sudden it kind of snowballs on them, and national signing day doesn't go the way they hope. So I just think it's more about kind of momentum and showing that incremental progress year to year, where a 10-win season kind of could really set them up for some bigger things in 2019.
How good is Central Florida?
They're quite good. They're really fast. They're not a particularly big team, but they've kind of made a name for themselves and made a living for themselves of taking the guys that maybe weren't necessarily big enough to be recruited by the Floridas or Miamis or Florida States of the world, but Florida is about as talent-rich as any state in the country when it comes to football talent. They're really fast. They operate at a pretty breakneck speed. I mean, they lead the nation in a lot of big play categories, 20-plus yard plays. They run about as many plays offensively as any team in the nation. I believe they're top 10 in both rushing yards and total offense and all those kind of numbers. So they just throw a lot of things at you offensively, and they try to turn every game into a track meet. I think if you're LSU, you don't really want to get in that kind of game with this team. If you're LSU, I think you want to run the ball, control the pace, eat the clock, maybe kind of pound away on what is a pretty quick defense, but ultimately a pretty small defense. So when it comes to just pure size against an LSU offensive line that's pretty large up front.
James, it does set the stage for next season, and as you note, LSU doesn't have as tough a schedule next year as it does this year, but there are some games on there that will be challenging, and you mentioned the Alabama game, and LSU has not defeated Alabama since 2011, and the prospect of beating them in Tuscaloosa would not seem to be good, but Ed Orgeron has recruited very well. Is he about to turn the corner and be able to compete at the highest levels of college football?
That's really the $4.5 million question, isn't it, Jim? I think this recruiting class is a big step, you know. But I do think there's a couple guys they need to close on between now and February. And if you're looking for a specific name, I'm talking about Ismail Shropshire out of AB. They need to get better on the offensive and defensive line. I mean, I think they've always been good enough in the defensive backfield. You throw in a guy like Derek Stingley, who's already practicing with the team. He's considered a generational talent at cornerback. They got a guy like Grant Delpit. If they can get somehow convince Devin White to return for his senior year, that would be another big step in the right direction. But it's going to come down to two things. Can they get the lines, both offensive and defensive, up to the level they need to be, and can they get the quarterback play they need? Because as well as guys like Danny Etling and Joe Burrow and whoever else you want to throw in there has played at times, none of those guys have seemed capable of playing any kind of a good game against Alabama when it's all on the line. And until you go, you see that, it's kind of hard to believe that it's coming. But I do think they're kind of, you know, and plus, as good as LSU's recruiting class is, Alabama is number one. So, yeah. I mean, as good as they're doing, is the gap really shrinking at all? I'm not so sure. So it's going to be tough. It's kind of a chicken and the egg. What happens first? Do they out-recruit them first to beat them, or do they beat them and then they can out-recruit them? But I think they're closer than they used to be, but it still seems like they've got a ways to go.
We're talking to James Moran, the editor of Tiger Rag Magazine, the Bible of LSU sports. He is in Arizona as LSU preps for a kickoff just a few hours away against Central Florida in the Fiesta Bowl. And this year's team, James, has been successful, but probably would not have been nearly as successful without a couple of transfers. The quarterback, Joe Burrow, the kicker, Cole Tracy, In many ways, they've been the backbone for this team, and that shows you what a couple of late additions can do.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't know where this team would be without Joe Burrow and Cole Tracy, and for the purposes of the bowl game, I would throw Terrence Alexander in there, considering how thin they are at cornerback, and he's going to have to step in there and start along with a couple of young guys who have all seen some playing time but are ultimately relatively inexperienced. Joe Burrow has really, I think, been the guy that kind of turned this season around, but I don't think you can underestimate how important Cole Tracy was. You know, the game-winning field goal at Auburn was, in my opinion, the biggest win of their season. I think the year goes in a totally different direction if they don't win that game. He kicked the 5 field goals against Georgia in what was their most impressive win of the season. I mean, he allowed them to be, I think, a more – the two of them combined, the fact that Burrow can move the ball and the fact that Cole Tracy always made sure they were converted into points is really what kind of made this an effective offense. You know, they've been good on defense, and they're normally pretty good on defense, but the ability of both the quarterback to move the ball and the kicker to make sure, even when it's not touchdowns, that that moving the ball translate into points, that's really been the backbone of this team. I think that's a pretty good assessment on your part.
Well, and Burrow has played almost the whole season, every play almost. And if something were to happen to him today, LSU might have some problems, James.
Yeah, I think Miles Brennan, they still have high hopes for him in the future. But, I mean, I don't think you've seen anything this year that would lead you to think that he could have played at as high of a level if he would have went in there. I mean, Joe Burrow is a very good runner, but they did not really run him with any kind of consistency until Texas A&M because they only had 2 scholarship quarterbacks. And if you just kind of read between the lines, it seems like they're not really ready to believe in Miles Brennan quite yet. So, no, I'd agree with you. I think without Burrow, they'd be in a lot of trouble. And if they hadn't gotten Burrow, then maybe this would have been a 6 or 7 win team as some of the experts had predicted before the year started.
Mm-hmm. And as we look at next year, the recruiting class is spectacular. Derek Stingley is on the cover of the latest Tiger Rag Extra, and he is the real deal, 5-star recruit from a local school. And it's quite an impressive collection of signees. And some of these guys, James, are huge. And we're talking over 350 pounds. How can a 17-year-old kid who weighs 356 pounds be in condition to play college football?
Well, who says they are quite yet? I think that's they always talk about how important that summer is and getting those guys in their first weight room program. You know, some of them are lucky and they go to schools with good facilities that have, you know, nice gyms and conditioning programs, but a lot of them are just kind of left to work out on their own, and, you know, their natural abilities get them this far, but it kind of comes down to how much they work out once they get in there with Tommy Moffitt and his crew. But, yeah, also Ed Orgeron loves those huge guys, man. I mean, he's got a lot of 350-plus-pound nose tackles on this team, as he's had since he took over as the recruiting coordinator, even before he was head coach. You look at Cardell Thomas, who's a 350-something-pound guard. They've got another 350-pound nose tackle in Apu Aika that they went and got out of Utah. So those guys, it's always a kind of a guessing game or a crapshoot, if you will, of who's going to be able to get in shape and who they can get the most out of. But they've definitely got some studs in this class, and mostly the in-state guys like Stingley, as you mentioned, and John Emery, the 5-star running back from Destrehan out of the New Orleans area.
And next year, they've already signed the top cornerback in the land, and he doesn't come from Destrehan or Baton Rouge. He's from California. How did they get him?
Elias Ricks. Well, I think mostly based on reputation. I mean, it's the number one. They didn't sign him yet. Just the point. He's just a commitment. I think it'll be another year before he can actually put any pen to paper. But he's just a commitment, and it seems like if you listen to the recruiting types, a pretty firm commitment. Number one, Corey Raymond, the defensive backs coach, has been out there working on him pretty consistently. They've actually spent a lot of time lately out in California recruiting.
Well, James, have a good game, and it's LSU and Central Florida coming in a few hours at the Fiesta Bowl. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana on WRKF.